The left hand gestures the convex push.
Ничего
не пишите.
Пишите.
Ничего не читайте.
Читайте.
Ничего не говорите.
Ничего не печатайте.
The right hand gestures a convex pull. The left hand gestures a concave pull. The right hand gestures a concave push. The left hand gestures a convex push. The right hand gestures a convex pull. The left hand gestures a concave pull. The right hand gestures a concave push. The left hand gestures a convex push.
possessing firearms. BBC News.
Now on Radio 4, the invention of Germany. Misha Glennie concludes his series about the rise of Europe's most powerful state.
We've driven some 3 hours from the old East Germany, past Prague eastwards, and I've come to the place where one of the most important battles, in my opinion, of the 19th century was fought. It took place in 1866, and I'm here with Veronika Ruzova, and Veronika is about to show me a muzzle-loading gun and how to fire it.
The caliber of this gun is about 13.9 millimeters, so it's a really large bullet.
Yes.
So,
down the barrel.
And now you should protect your ears because
okay.
It will be really...
It's very loud. Okay, get ready for this.
1866 is really the end of the Holy Roman Empire, and it's the beginning of a modern power state, a modern nation state, the surgical operation to get rid of Austria.
Well, first of all, it has to liberate itself from the Austrian preeminence, and Germany was considered to be the smaller sibling, as it were, when in reality the scales were tipped against the Austrians, not against the Germans, but the other around, as Bismarck had understood. So he just set the record straight by showing them he was boss.
There are uniforms here. I'm looking at the grey-coated Austrian uniform, and it looks slightly pompous, slightly old-fashioned, comical even, set next to the Prussian uniform, which is much tighter, and of course there's that really threatening spike on top of the helmets of the Prussian army.
For me, 1866 is not a war of unification, it's a war of division, because actually that's the moment when Austria, which has always been part of Germany, is finally thrown out. So it's not really a moment of unification. I think it's much more a war of division, and then what emerges is a Germany which claims to be the continuation of an earlier Germany, but it's actually in lots of ways a very different thing.
In these three programmes about Germany and where it came from, we've only really mentioned Austria in passing. And yet the Austrians speak German. More than that, Austrian Habsburgs in Vienna had been emperors for centuries of that ghostly medieval institution, the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation. You've just heard Abigail Green of Oxford University, together with Michael Stürmer and Thomas Kielinger of Die Welt newspaper, talking about the seismic events of 1866, when Prussia decided that there was only room for one top dog amongst German speakers. Prussia, in Bismarck's famous phrase, unified Germany by blood and iron. Austria was left out. But there was nothing inevitable about this process. In fact, the peculiar mechanism by which Germany moved from some 400 separate states to a single unit on the European map had huge implications for what came next, namely two world wars. This programme is about that build-up, and Germany's attempt to define itself, indeed to stamp itself on the map. Norman Davis is the author of Vanished Kingdoms.
Everything was decided by military strength, but also by a revolutionary idea that there were parts of the map which were reserved, as it were, by the Almighty for particular nations. Blut und Boden, i.e. blood and soil. And they really believed that there is something called German soil, that if you pick up a handful of soil, that this is German, and it's different from the soil 50 yards to the other side of the border, which is called French soil. This idea is extremely strong.
But should your neighbour not agree with your definition, then the prospects for war were also extremely strong. We've travelled some 400 miles by road from Germany's eastern flank, where Prussia clashed with Austria in 1866, to the greatest point of friction in the west. This area, now French, has been called both Alsace-Lorraine and Elsass-Lothringen. I'm in front of a charcuterie But if I look at the road signs, they're pointing to places like Obersteinbach, Niedersteinbach, Wörth, and there's even a Chateau de Fleckenstein here as well, just before a sign pointing to the Maginot Line. We spoke to one expert for this programme who called the endless fight between France and Germany over this borderland a classic piece of pseudo-medievalist, map-filled idiocy. Bismarck, flushed with his triumph over Austria, took it over in 1871. The first French act of World War I was a suicidal charge to get it back, which they eventually did in 1918, lost it again in 1940, before retaking Metz and Strasbourg. Just how German do those names sound, in 1944. My point? Well, the process by which Germany groped for unification, the wars, the ideas, are central to understanding what Europe is today. It's first worth considering, therefore, what Germany was before this process began. Abigail Green again.
Well, this is a patchwork country. Every time you cross a border, the uniforms change, the tolls change, the whole system of operation changes.
And did they have, for example, a common currency at this point?
No.
So if you were a sort of determined traveller, Germany was a bit of a nightmare.
It was a nightmare, but I think that tolls and separate states, that's not something which is restricted to Germany in this period. I mean, if you think of Italy. But what I would say is Germany is actually a political entity. It has got political functions. So I think it's wrong to see it as just a kind of cultural language zone. It's also joined by certain political practices and reference points like the emperor.
The Habsburg emperors of the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation, as bewildering a title as it sounds, had been in post with one short break since 1452. Then, in 1806, a rampaging, rationalising Napoleon abolished it overnight, and suddenly the fragmentary 400-state chaos of the Reich was reduced to 39. Chief among these was the state poised to lead the way, Prussia. Their role in defeating Napoleon at Waterloo raised them to great power status, still far behind the British, the Russians and the Austrians, admittedly, but the reshuffling of the post-Napoleonic map had huge consequences. Norman Davis again.
Prussia, having been essentially a country of East Germany, became the largest state within Germany, stretching all the way to the Rhine, and the biggest industrial area of the 19th century, the Ruhr, fell into Prussia's lap, more or less by good fortune. Cologne, Catholic Cologne, was the great city of Prussia in the west.
So the net effect of the Napoleonic Wars, once Napoleon's been defeated, is to pull Prussia towards the west and away from its origins in the east.
Absolutely.
More than 500 steps up at the top of Cologne Cathedral's Gothic twin towers, I've got a bird's-eye view over Germany's industrial heartland. I'm looking east now across the majestic Rhine at the industrial suburb of Deutz, where a certain Mr. Daimler worked on the world's first piston engine. Just round the bend to the north, there's Bayer's mighty pharmaceutical works in Leverkusen. Beyond that, the Ruhr, home to Krupps, Siemens, and all the other firms that turned barren little Prussia into an industrial leviathan. Now, the people of Cologne, Catholic, cosmopolitan, and frankly a lot more fun than the dour Lutherans from the East, didn't really care for the new arrangement imposed on them. The place wasn't even physically attached to Prussia because the Kingdom of Hanover lies in between. How ironic, then, that Western cities like this provided the economic muscle that led to Prussia's unstoppable rise.
The Ruhr district becomes the most powerful iron, coal, industrial region of the whole of Europe. This led to coal and steel means guns. And suddenly, to everybody's surprise, this once peripheral German state had become the strongest power in Europe. The King of Prussia becomes the Emperor of Germany. And that is the time where a sense of Germanity can really take off.
But before we get carried away with the inevitability of all of this, the rise of Prussia, the defeat of Austria in 1866, and the defeat of France in the Franco-Prussian War of 1870 and 71, consider this leader in the Times newspaper, dated just one decade before. Prussia, it said, was always leaning on somebody, always getting somebody to help her, never willing to help herself, present in congresses, but absent in battles. It goes on. She has a large army, but notoriously one in no condition for fighting. No one counts her as a friend. No one dreads her as an enemy. So what has changed? The answer is Otto von Bismarck Schönhausen, Prime Minister of Prussia from 1862 and First Chancellor of the German Empire from 1871.
Bismarck is really a political opportunist. He's not really thinking necessarily about forming a German nation-state at all.
He thought of nationhood as a means to an end to become an important player in world history.
And it's only as things develop that he seizes his opportunity.
Acknowledged as the greatest statesman of the 19th century, Bismarck was, in fact, one of the grumpiest hypochondriacs in European history. He was a Junker, part of the Prussian landowning class and usually pictured with his trademark handlebar moustache under a spiked helmet. He seems like the epitome of German nationalism. But according to Thomas Kielinger, he had surprisingly little emotional interest in unification.
There's a famous saying somewhere in his diaries or letters, "To me a war against the King of Bavaria or anywhere else in Germany would be just the same as a war against France. I have no track with national identity." And it's interesting that he was really not much of a German patriot. He was very cool about identity. He had just one idea in mind, which was power.
Almost two decades earlier, Europe's monarchies had been convulsed by events that on the surface at least have much in common with the Arab Spring of 2011. The influence on the young Bismarck was profound. The year is 1848, a time of revolution right across Europe, an explosion of rising aspirations, national, economic, democratic, that existing regimes are unable to fulfil. Simon Winder is the author of Germania.
I think 1848 is a failure of government, effectively. There's a overall weakness in the way that Europe's run in this period, not helped by the fact that the Emperor of Austria is himself a simpleton, and is unable to effectively take any serious decisions. There's this sort of growing sense of anarchy, all really to do with the fact that no one quite knows what to do next.
It begins in Palermo, down in Sicily, spreads to Paris, and soon there are demonstrations in Cologne, Vienna, Berlin, and beyond. Now, in Germany, the key question that they had to answer is, how are we going to unite all these disparate territories, both emotionally and geographically? To answer this question, they came here to the Paulskirche, St. Paul's Church, for the so-called Frankfurt Parliament of 1848. Now, the interior was dominated by a giant painting called Germania, a female figure crowned in oak leaves, carrying a sword and with a cast-off manacle at her feet. It was the perfect symbol of a suppressed people struggling for breath, and had their aspirations been met, then German unification might not have been the bloody mess it eventually became. In Frankfurt, we met Wiebke Singer of Reuters, who moonlights now and then as a city tour guide.
When the parliament came together for the first time, they had over 600 delegates. And it was really hard because the whole population was allowed to send petitions to the assembly. The idea was to come up with a constitution for the whole of Germany, of all the states, to bring them together. Quite a difficult task, really.
What sort of people came to Frankfurt in 1848?
It was all highly educated people from a certain level, a certain income. You had a lot of professors, you had a lot of lawyers. So it wasn't, in inverted commas, a normal society. It wasn't you and me. It was all sort of upper class.
So it was rich people, well-educated and articulate, and they could talk for hours and hours.
And they sure did, as you can imagine.
The most important new development in 1848 from a German perspective is that people are trying to solve problems nationally in a new way. So the Frankfurt Parliament, that's the first attempt to do that.
Abigail Green, the biggest problem they've faced? What size should Germany be? And in particular, how would this new state accommodate the non-German-speaking territories of the Austrian Habsburgs? Why is Austria such a problem?
I would say it's not just Austria as we know it today. It's all the other countries, like Hungary, for example, where, of course, they speak a different language. And that was one of the main issues, that they really wanted to have a Germany where German was spoken and not necessarily different languages.
So we saw in 1848 this clash between the Austrian idea of Germany and the Prussian idea of Germany.
That's right, that's right. And Austria said, we are up for it, we would join, but not if we have to split our country.
1848 is like a kind of fast forward of the problems of German unification, and the Frankfurt Parliament, they go through these questions. Is it going to be a monarchy? Is it going to be a republic? Is it going to be Grossdeutsch? Is it going to be Kleindeutsch? Because before 1848, everyone assumes that whatever might happen to Germany will actually look in some form like the Holy Roman Empire, and it'll have a Habsburg. After 1848, it becomes clear that actually the Habsburgs don't really fit in there because their interests are kind of too diverse, and so a different solution comes to the fore.
Perhaps the most important character of 1848, Karl Marx, was not involved in the dealings of the Frankfurt Parliament, which ended in a state of utter disarray. In fact, all the springtime revolutions collapsed after the authorities recovered their nerve. Repression was again the order of the day. With all the monarchs once more on their thrones, a peaceful route to German unity had been lost. But for one onlooker, lessons had been learnt. Michael Stürmer, academic, columnist, and former advisor to Helmut Kohl.
Bismarck saw what happened in Frankfurt was highly dangerous for his status as a Prussian aristocrat. He talks about the Nationalschwindel, that's the national swindle. Why is he against it? Nationalism comes from the left, not from the right. And every right-minded aristocrat, with very few exceptions, shared that belief, and so did Bismarck.
Does he have, at this early stage in his political life, a vision of where Prussia and where Germany ought to be going? Or is he entirely pragmatic?
In the early days, he has a vision of himself. He wants to play first fiddle, and he doesn't care who under him would be king. Now, Prussia at that time was, after Britain and France, perhaps Belgium, the leading industrial power. And Prussia was also modernizing at a very rapid pace. And that meant that those scattered lands of Prussia, one part in the west, a bigger part in the east, had to be brought into a contiguous political landscape, not as a kind of backward agricultural state like the Danube monarchy.
So he understood that Austria, in many senses, was a drain on Prussia and on modernization. Do you think there was a moment when he woke up saying, we've got to rid ourselves of the Austrian burden once and for all?
Well, of course. That is when he becomes prime minister.
Marx famously said, you know, great men are able to use events to their advantage, and that's exactly what he does.
He became prime minister in order to defend the monarchy against change. But he also said our borders are intolerable. And as they cannot be solved through speeches and resolutions in parliament, they have to be solved by iron and blood.
Well, I've just walked up an extremely tall outlook tower, but from here I have a spectacular view of where the battle took place.
Bismarck had a window of opportunity. Get rid of Austria. Throw Austria out of all things German. And don't forget that this is the time of the American Civil War. There were more important things to watch.
Well, he was a chancellor, and he had a strong militia at his disposal. So he put two to go together and said, well, I can risk it.
I'm now holding an 8-pound shell. These things created absolute mayhem in the Austrian ranks.
Prussians, of course, were much more modern in their equipment, in their strategy, in their tactics. You had the genius of Moltke, and Moltke knew much better than the Austrians what the railways would mean. No great displays of horsepower, but railway, fast movements, encirclement. So a decisive battle of Königgrätz compared to battles of the 20th century was, relatively speaking, a modest affair, although there were 500,000 armed men on both sides.
The Great Battle of Königgrätz was in fact just one of three wars that Bismarck and the Prussians conducted. The first, against the Danes, and fought in collaboration with the Austrians, secured the territory of Schleswig-Holstein. The second, against the Austrians, put Prussia in the box seat, able to dictate events. And the third, against the French, made Prussia the leading power on all of mainland Europe. Three wars, all conducted with lightning speed. The continent would never again be the same. The crowning moment, 1871, sees the Prussian king anointed leader of the new German Empire, the Second Reich. Not in Berlin, but in the Palace of Mirrors in Versailles outside Paris. A quite staggering event.
I'm still tempted to write about the tragedy of success. Success is not good for you. Too much success is not good for you.
If you want to get a physical sense of how Germany has changed, you need to come here to Thüringen, in the very geographical heart of Germany. And on top of a hill called Kufhäuser, where I am now, there is a vast and pretty sinister monument. Down below, there is a statue of Barbarossa, the 12th century Holy Roman Emperor, who symbolized the last time that Germany had been united. But above him, riding on a huge horse, is William I, the Emperor Wilhelm, who was crowned in 1871, who reunited Germany, thus reimagining Barbarossa's collapsed empire. As I said, it's not only sinister, but it's really quite threatening, and people who came to visit it at the time must have been stunned by the way Germany was now projecting itself, no longer the fractured, helpless, split-up nation of many tongues and princes and entities, but a single nation which wanted its piece of the world and wasn't going to be stopped from getting it. Many Germans now agree that Prussia overreached, particularly with regard to that small area of borderland we mentioned earlier, Alsace-Lorraine, renamed Elsass-Lothringen after the Franco-Prussian War. Thomas Kielinger again.
It was really the Palestinian-Israeli conflict of the 19th century. And Bismarck said after he had created the Reich and Elsass-Lorraine had become German again, Elsass-Lothringen, he said, that is the last piece of expansion. I am now a satisfied Reich. Bonkers. Nothing can be satisfied when your neighbour swears eternal revenge for the rapacious acquisition of a piece that he considers his own. That created in the mind of the French this absolute enmity.
Bismarck made a huge mistake, and he knew he was making a tragic mistake by annexing Alsace and Lorraine.
You have unending problems. And Bismarck, I think, committed the cardinal mistake of Germany's history. I think you just cannot exaggerate the huge error that he committed by reacquiring Alsace-Lorraine and incorporating it into the German Reich.
Well, Bismarck foresaw what might be coming. And he always warned that Germany should be a little less grandiose than it appeared. There were great temptations, and especially in his criticism of Wilhelm II, he was scathing.
A second problem, less relevant for us perhaps, but certainly in the 19th century an issue for Germans themselves, not all of them wanted to be part of this new Prussian experiment. In fact, many of them didn't want unification at all.
If you had asked the burghers of Cologne at that time whether they would rather be loyal to Vienna or to Berlin, the answer would have been very clear. We hate Berlin. To this present day, I would say, there are certain uneasy feelings about the capital in the southern and western parts of Germany, and that dates back to the days of Bismarck.
At the beginning of this series, we travelled to Bavaria, another region with no love for Berlin and the North. Our reason? A slightly whimsical trip to see the horse of Gustavus Adolphus, the King of the Swedes. Talking afterwards to the curator, Dr. Beatrix Schönewald, I asked what she as a Bavarian thought of the unification of 1871.
It was forced by Prussia, a not beloved partner who has beaten Bavaria, into a Kaiserreich, and they have treated the Bavarian king not very diplomatical, and this was a sort of treason.
Strong words, suggesting this really was a unification imposed by blood and iron. But then Beatrix said something even more surprising, namely that for her, the real unification of Germany, the first unification, if you like, only occurred when the Berlin Wall collapsed.
I don't think that the idea of a united Germany really exists until the unification of the two states in 1989.
And can we say now that the borders of Germany, which have changed so much over many centuries, are now fixed borders?
I'm no prophet.
As a child, my father told me amazing stories about a divided Berlin where he'd once been stationed. And it's a real comfort to me that he actually saw the wall tumble a few months before he died. Germany's taken a long time to find itself and for the rest of Europe to feel happy with who she is. It'd be foolish to pretend that Europe doesn't still face serious problems, but that's not to suggest Germany is ever likely to repeat the mistakes of the past.
The Invention of Germany was presented by Misha Glenny, and the series was produced in Bristol by Miles Ward. Next week, we bring you a programme that marks an anniversary many would prefer to forget. The first lobotomy in the US. Why were tens of thousands of people lobotomised in the 1940s and 50s, not just in the States, but in this country too? The lobotomists tell the story next Monday night at 8. Analysis is coming up. First, this chap seems happy to be back on BBC Radio 4.
Mark Watson, Mark Watson's, Mark Watson's live address to the nation.
It's called Mark Watson's Live Address to the Nation, and that's exactly what it is. It is a series of addresses on the subject of various kind of personal qualities.
Mark Watson.
Doctor, what are you doing with my wife, sir?
What you believe? Having sexual intercourse?
Oh, I think I forgot.
Justice to the people.
For God's sake,
give more justice to the people.
For God's sake,
forward food justice to the people. Justice to the young.
Sait asıl adın, yırtıcı kuş adın aldım. Mehmet Sait asıl adın, yırtıcı kuş adın aldım. Bir atılgan şahin oldum, yuva tuttum yüceleri, yüceleri. Bir atılgan şahin oldum, yuva tuttum yüceleri, yüceleri. Çapalıya ota kurdum, beri hayra gelir oldum. Dört cephede cenge girdim, duman ettim niceleri. Dört cephede cenneye girdim, duman ettim niceleri, duman ettim niceleri. Fidanını diktim,
Kan olup göçüne aktım. Umut fidanını diktim. Kan olup göçüne aktım. Karanlığa yıldız ektim. Siperlerde geceleri, geceleri. Karanlığa yıldız ektim. Siperlerde geceleri, geceleri. 6000 al yıldız aktı. Bizim şafak böyle söktü. Şehitlere yaktı sona boyu bacıları. Şehitlere ağıt yaktı sona boyu bacıları. Sona boyu bacıları.
twice as much as the loot of the 1963 Great Train Robbery. Well, a cargo of this kind of value is an obvious target for robbery. It is common to find such valuable consignments lumbering along our road. I put that to John Edward, Commodities Editor of the Financial
наричане «Дейспен реален хуманизм днес». И независимо от възможните различия във възгледите, под цвета на Германа, верността към крайните идеи и идеали на хуманизма е обединителната цел, която събира творческата активност и социалната отговорност на учените.
Look.